Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, March 29th, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. The murder trial of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin and the death of George Floyd begins with the jury seeing and hearing early on the 9-minute-plus video of Floyd gasping, "I can't breathe," witnesses telling Chauvin to get off Floyd's neck, and then Floyd going unresponsive. President Joe Biden urging state and local officials to reconsider lifting their coronavirus restrictions and reinstate mask mandates as the U.S. faces an increase in cases. And CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky warns of what she calls impending doom of a fourth surge if people do not take precautions. She says, quote, "Right now, I'm scared." The Biden administration extends a federal moratorium on evictions of tenants who have fallen behind on rent during the coronavirus pandemic. The moratorium was scheduled to expire on Wednesday. It'll now run through the end of June. And the U.S. suspends all trade with Myanmar after a weekend of violence against pro-democracy protesters by the military, which seized power in a coup 2 months ago. United States Trade Representative Catherine Tai says the suspension will remain in effect until the return of a democratically elected government in Myanmar. Now to the trial in Minneapolis in the case of the death of George Floyd. The day began with civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump, lawyer for the Floyd family, holding a news conference outside the courtroom, calling the trial a referendum on how far America has come on its quest for equality and justice for all, and calling the video of former officer Derek Chauvin with his knee on George Floyd's neck a torture video, and saying there would be no question whether Chauvin would get convicted if Floyd were white. Inside the courtroom, with the jury seated, Minnesota Assistant Special Attorney General Jerry Blackwell said that Chauvin betrayed his badge.
So in terms of the charges that we are bringing, we're going to prove to you that Mr. Chauvin's conduct was a substantial cause of Mr. Floyd's death. We've charged him with murder in the second degree, murder in the third degree, and manslaughter for using excessive force against George Floyd. You will learn that the use of excessive and unreasonable force against a citizen is an assault. In this case, we will show you that this was an assault that contributed to taking his life, an assault. We're going to show you that putting knees on somebody's neck, Mr. Floyd's, putting a knee on his back for 9 minutes and 29 seconds was an imminently dangerous activity, and he did it without regard to what impact it had on Mr. Floyd's life. We're going to show you that also. Putting him on the ground, we call that the prone position, on your stomach, face down. Putting him in the prone position, handcuffed like this in the first place, was uncalled for and was an excessive use of force, let alone for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Now, how are we going to prove these charges? We're going to prove it, ladies and gentlemen, first and foremost by witness testimony. We're going to bring in some of those bystanders that I've referred to, normal folks. They'll tell you what they saw. They'll tell you why they stopped. They'll tell you why they were concerned. They'll tell you from that witness chair. We'll bring them in here. You're going to hear from any number of police officers responsible for training, responsible for what the officers learn around first aid, coming to the care of others. We'll bring in a number of police officers, including the chief of police. But we're also going to bring in various professionals and experts, medical experts, experts in police conduct. You're going to meet any number of them.
Jerry Blackwell, one of the special prosecutors in the trial. The death of George Floyd was May 25th, 2020, after he was arrested on suspicion of using a counterfeit $20 bill to buy cigarettes. You might remember it set off weeks of protests and riots across the country. You also heard the prosecutor refer to 9 minutes and 29 seconds, whereas for the past year or so, it's been 8 minutes and 46 seconds. It's become the symbol of police brutality. CNN explains that the 8:46 timing initially was included in a criminal complaint against Chauvin. That number was based on bystander video of Floyd's death that went viral and led to public outrage. The video, which is over 10 minutes long, begins with Chauvin already on Floyd's neck, so it's not immediately clear how long he had been on Floyd prior to the video's start. And it appears that the defense accepted the 9 minutes and 29 seconds presented today. After the prosecution's opening statement, attorney for the defendant, Eric Nelson, told the jury that George Floyd died due to underlying medical conditions and drug use.
The autopsy revealed many other issues, including coronary disease, an enlarged heart, what's called a paraganglioma, which is a tumor that secretes adrenaline, swelling or edema of the lungs. And the state was not satisfied with Dr. Baker's work. And so they have contracted with numerous physicians to contradict Dr. Baker's findings. And this will ultimately be another significant battle in this trial. What was Mr. Floyd's actual cause of death? The evidence will show that Mr. Floyd died of a cardiac arrhythmia that occurred as a result of hypertension, his coronary disease, the ingestion of methamphetamine and fentanyl, and the adrenaline flowing through his body, all of which acted to further compromise an already compromised heart. At the conclusion of this evidence, you will be instructed as to the law, the elements of the offense, and the court will give you detailed instructions on what you must find to convict Mr. Chauvin of these charges. But when you review the actual evidence, and when you hear the law and apply reason and common sense, there will only be one just verdict, and that is to find Mr. Chauvin not guilty.
Attorney Eric Nelson. The case, State of Minnesota versus Derek Chauvin, was filed in Hennepin County District Court, the trial being held in downtown Minneapolis at the County Government Center, which is surrounded by fencing now and fortified. Also, due to coronavirus pandemic and high public interest in the case, the trial is being broadcast live. We're carrying it on the C-SPAN networks. It'll be archived at cspan.org. In addition to the opening statements today from the attorneys, testifying some of the witnesses, a 911 dispatcher who watched the police pin George Floyd to the ground on a surveillance camera and said it went on for so long she asked someone if the screens had frozen. Also, two of the witnesses that were on the scene. At the White House today, the press secretary Jen Psaki asked if President Joe Biden has been following the trial.
I want to talk about George Floyd. Will the president be watching or receiving updates on Derek Chauvin's trial today? And has he been in touch with George Floyd's family in the lead up to the trial?
Well, he certainly will be watching closely, as Americans across the country will be watching. At the time of George Floyd's death, he talked about this as being an event that really opened up a wound in the American public, and it really brought to light for a lot of people in this country just the kind of racial injustice and inequality that many communities are experiencing every single day. And he'll be watching it closely. He'll certainly be provided updates. Obviously, this is a trial that's working its way through a law enforcement or a legal process, so we wouldn't weigh in further than that. But these were events that at the time he spoke about as being just a reminder of also the need to, and it certainly impacted how he's thought about in his own government, making equity central to what we do, instituting and putting in place racial injustice and addressing racial injustice as a priority, one of the key crises that he believes he is facing and we are all facing as a country. So it will continue to be central to what we do, and he will, of course, be watching the trial closely.
Have you spoken to the family of George Floyd in the lead-up to the trial?
I don't have any calls to read out. He obviously spoke to them, or not obviously. For those of you who didn't follow this closely, he did speak to them last spring and spoke at the time and commented at the time about their grace. And I know he conveyed that. And he was just impressed by their courage, and he continues to believe that.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. Derek Chauvin, again, charged with second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter. If he's convicted of the most serious charge, he could face 10.5 years to 15 years in prison under sentencing guidelines for first-time offenders. Trial expected to last 2 to 4 weeks. Now to the coronavirus pandemic, a new CDC study showing strong evidence that mRNA coronavirus vaccines, such as the ones approved from Pfizer and Moderna, are highly effective in preventing SARS-CoV-2 infections in real-world conditions. But CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky saying she's scared that even with vaccines being successfully rolled out, complacency with basic precautions such as mask use and social distancing could lead to yet another surge of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths.
When I first started at CDC about 2 months ago, I made a promise to you. I would tell you the truth, even if it was not the news we wanted to hear. Now is one of those times when I have to share the truth and I have to hope and trust you will listen. I'm going to pause here. I'm going to lose the script, and I'm going to reflect on the recurring feeling I have of impending doom. We have so much to look forward to, so much promise and potential of where we are, and so much reason for hope. But right now, I'm scared. I know what it's like as a physician to stand in that patient room, gowned, gloved, masked, shielded, and to be the last person to touch someone else's loved one because their loved one couldn't be there. I know what it's like when you're the physician, when you're the healthcare provider, and you're worried that you don't have the resources to take care of the patients in front of you. I know that feeling of nausea when you read the crisis standards of care and you wonder whether there are going to be enough ventilators to go around and who's going to make that choice. And I know what it's like to pull up to your hospital every day and see the extra morgue sitting outside. I didn't know at the time when it would stop. We didn't have the science to tell us. We were just scared. We have come such a long way. Three historic scientific breakthrough vaccines, and we are rolling them out so very fast. So I'm speaking today not necessarily as your CDC director, and not only as your CDC director, but as a wife, as a mother, as a daughter, to ask you to just please hold on a little while longer. I so badly want to be done. I know you all so badly want to be done. We are just almost there, but not quite yet. And so I'm asking you to just hold on a little longer, to get vaccinated when you can, so that all of those people that we all love will still be here when this pandemic ends. The trajectory of the pandemic in the United States looks similar to many other countries in Europe, including Germany, Italy, and France, look like just a few weeks ago. And since that time, those countries have experienced a consistent and worrying spike in cases. We are not powerless. We can change this trajectory of the pandemic, but it will take all of us recommitting to following the public health prevention strategies consistently while we work to get the American public vaccinated.
Dr. Rochelle Walensky, director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, during today's White House COVID-19 response team virtual briefing. The U.S. is averaging about 63,000 new COVID-19 cases per day over the past week, and that's a 16% increase from the week before, according to Johns Hopkins University. President Joe Biden, in a separate event at the White House today, sharing Dr. Walensky's concerns.
Our work is far from over. The war against COVID-19 is far from won. This is deadly serious. We share the sentiment of Dr. Walensky, the head of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. The CDC expressed earlier today, this is not a time to lessen our efforts. That's what she said. We could still see a setback in the vaccination program. And most importantly, if we let our guard down now, we could see a virus getting worse, not better. You know, as many people as we've vaccinated, we still have more Americans left to go. You know, we will administer more shots in March than any country on earth. But even so, we have to give more shots in April than we did in March. Because we're in the life and death race with the virus that is spreading quickly, with cases rising again, new variants are spreading, and sadly, some of the reckless behavior we've seen on television over the past few weeks means that more new cases are to come in the weeks ahead. With vaccines, there's hope, which is a very good thing, to state the obvious. But people are letting up on precautions, which is a very bad thing. Look, to this point, cases have fallen two-thirds since I took office. Deaths have also fallen two-thirds. But now cases are going back up. In some states, deaths are as well. You know, we're giving up hard-fought, hard-won gains. And as much as we're doing, America, it's time to do even more. All of us have to do our part, every one of us.
President Biden at the White House. He also announced some new speedier vaccination goals, saying by April 19th, 90% of all American adults should be eligible to be vaccinated and that a vaccination site be within 5 miles of 90% of all Americans. Politico also reporting the Biden administration rethinking a costly system of government-run mass vaccination sites after data revealed the program is lagging well behind a much cheaper federal effort to distribute doses via retail pharmacies. This from the Associated Press, a joint World Health Organization China study on the origins of COVID-19 says that transmission of the virus from bats to humans through another animal is the most likely scenario and that a lab leak is extremely unlikely, according to a draft copy obtained by AP. Article also notes that repeated delays in the report's release have raised questions about whether the Chinese side was trying to skew its conclusions. A member of the WHO team, Peter Daszak, was interviewed on Sunday by CBS's 60 Minutes.
I'm on the WHO team for a reason. And, you know, if you're going to work in China on coronaviruses and try and understand their origins, you should involve the people who know the most about that. And for better or for worse, I do.
He says the team did look into the leak theory during a visit with lab scientists and deemed it extremely unlikely.
We met with them. We said, do you audit the lab? And they said, annually? Did you audit it after the outbreak? Yes. Was anything found? No. Do you test your staff? Yes.
No. But you're just taking their word for it.
Well, what else can we do? There's a limit to what you can do, and we went right up to that limit. We asked them tough questions. They weren't vetted in advance, and the answers they gave we found to be believable, correct, and convincing.
Peter Daszak with the World Health Organization on the CBS News program 60 Minutes on Sunday, interviewed by Leslie Stahl. The report on the origins of COVID-19 from WHO and China expected to be made public on Tuesday. This is Washington Today. Many news outlets reporting that U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer exploring how to pass President Biden's third economic spending bill later this year without any Republican votes by using the budget reconciliation process for a third time in 1 year. He's been talking to the parliamentarian about how to do that. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki asked about this and also about the second big spending package on infrastructure expected to be presented this week.
Earlier, Majority Leader Schumer is making the case that budget reconciliation can be used once more in the fiscal year 2021. If the Senate parliamentarian agrees his argument, this could be used a couple more times over the next year or so. Does the White House support that move, and what would it mean for the president's agenda?
Well, the White House and the president will leave the mechanics of bill passing to Leader Schumer and other leaders in Congress. Our focus is on proposing an agenda, an ambitious agenda, to invest in infrastructure, to help caregivers across the country, to ensure that we are doing more to help Americans get through this challenging period of time. Go ahead.
Thanks, Jen. On infrastructure, since the president is set to unveil his proposal in a couple of days now, what is his current thinking or his economic advisor's current thinking on how much of this package needs to be paid for with tax revenue?
Well, the president has a plan to fix the infrastructure of our country. We're currently 13th in the world. No one believes we should be there. And he has a plan to pay for it, which he will propose. But right now, once he proposes that, our focus is also on having that engagement and discussion with members of Congress. If they share a goal of building our infrastructure for the future but don't like the way he's going to propose to pay for it, we're happy to look at their proposals. If they don't want to pay for it, I guess they can propose that too. Maybe they don't support infrastructure spending. So the president has an ambitious goal. The most important thing is to figure out how to invest in, put forward the investments in our much needed that are much needed in our infrastructure. What's irresponsible is not to address the urgent needs of that investment, but the means and mechanisms of paying for it. We look forward to presenting his plans, but also hearing proposals for others who may have a difference of view.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. President Biden plans to lay out that first part of the next economic recovery package on Wednesday in Pittsburgh, focusing on rebuilding roads, bridges, and other infrastructure. And then a separate plan later in April addressing other elements of infrastructure, as the White House sees it, child care and health care. Some early reaction on whether This infrastructure spending could get bipartisan support. Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito was on Greta Van Susteren's Full Court Press.
We just passed in a bipartisan way, unanimous, big water and drinking water infrastructure package, a five-year package, which is great. We're going to do the same thing with surface transportation. Here's my problem. $3 trillion social infrastructure on top of this. I mean, this is just a reshaping of the definition of infrastructure, number one, but also reshaping the way that we've always addressed these problems, which are together, whether it's roads, bridges, ports, airports, broadband, whatever we would consider infrastructure. Does this country want to provide free community college? That's part of this bill. Pre-K for every state. That's what I'm reading. They haven't come out with the entire bill yet. I haven't seen it, but this is what the pre-reports are. These are discussions that we should be having all across the board. You're really disenfranchising a great part of the country when you don't include other voices.
Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia with reporter Greta Van Susteren on her podcast. Another Republican Senator, John Kennedy of Louisiana, was on Fox News Sunday Morning Futures this weekend.
The motto of the Biden administration is, we can't spend too much. And at the rate they're going, we're going to run out of digits. He's talking $3 trillion on infrastructure. There will be money bills behind that. He is going to raise taxes dramatically. He's going to make tax policy on the basis of class warfare. That's not how you make tax policy. You make tax policy on the basis of sound economic principles. He's going to say we're going to raise the taxes on the rich because he really does believe that we're one tax increase away from prosperity. I predict it'll have a profound impact, especially if he tinkers with capital gains and dividends. It'll have a profound impact on the economy. When you tax something, Maria, you get less of it. And business never grew by raising their taxes.
Senator John Kennedy on Fox News on Sunday, and joining us now with more on President Joe Biden's expected infrastructure spending proposal is Ellen Nielsen, a White House reporter with Vox.com. Thanks so much for being with us. We've been hearing a lot about what might be in this package when it's unveiled this week. What are you hearing is the latest?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we're going to see is a pretty broad infrastructure package. So, and by broad, I mean it's going to be more than what people might conventionally think of as infrastructure. So it's going to be more than just roads and bridges. I think that the Biden White House, from folks that I have talked to, really sees this infrastructure plan as their best chance to really fight back on climate change and really kind of reroute the U.S. economy more towards clean energy, get to some pretty ambitious climate goals that they have laid out, including getting the U.S. economy electricity sector to 100% clean energy by 2035. In addition to everything that is going to be in this, you know, climate, clean energy, infrastructure package, so we're talking about more electric vehicle charging stations on the highways, things like modernizing the electrical grid, other things like that. In addition to that, there's also potentially going to be sort of a what some people are calling a human infrastructure package. So things that deal with the care economy, childcare, universal pre-K, long-term care. So there's going to be a lot potentially in these packages.
And the total price tag, originally we were hearing $3 trillion. I've seen that it might actually be higher.
Yeah, I think we'll know more on Wednesday when President Biden kind of unveils this. But I think that it could be, you know, potentially $3 to $4 trillion. Of course, the White House is looking at ways to pay for this. That includes potentially, you know, raising the corporate tax rate, taxing individuals and households making over $400,000. So certainly, you know, how to pay for it is always a subject up for debate on Capitol Hill between Republicans and Democrats. It's worth remembering that President Biden's first package that has already been passed, the American Rescue Plan, that dealt with COVID-19 and vaccinations. You know, it was pitched originally as a $1.9 trillion package, and it didn't really come down from that number. Even though Biden met with Republicans, they wanted it to come down dramatically. And, you know, certainly some things were changed in it, but the overall price tag on his COVID package stayed at $1.9 trillion. So again, I'm sure, you know, this is going to be a starting point, but it will be interesting to see if the White House really kind of stays on a $3 to $4 trillion number, or if they show any signs of coming down at all.
We've heard from some Republicans already that they're not going to go for this, but the White House is talking about maybe picking up some Republican support. What would it take to get to that?
I think that from what I've heard from Republicans so far, Republicans really want an infrastructure package that is a roads and bridges package. I mean, there is a surface, a five-year reauthorization for a surface transportation bill that is coming up this year that the House and Senate both want to pass and get done by September. They have a September deadline. And I think that, you know, that package is leaving out the rest of the stuff that the Biden administration is going to propose. You know, roads and bridges are fairly common sense bipartisan things. And Republicans, I think there is potentially some appetite on that. But I think that really where there might be a little bit more pushback is depending on how ambitious some of these climate proposals are. I think that, you know, some Republicans are willing to work with Democrats on clean energy. It's but also there is going to be pushback if, you know, it's really a huge focus away from fossil fuels and oil and coal. So there are going to be a number of things that I think are sticking points beyond just sort of the roads and bridges. And, you know, infrastructure is always talked about as the most bipartisan thing on Capitol Hill. But I think that the really big fight here is going to be the scale and the size of this package.
We're talking with Ella Nielsen with Vox.com. Infrastructure is popular, and we've also heard now that earmarks may be back. What kind of role might that play?
Yeah, so earmarks, it could be interesting to see if that makes Republicans maybe more willing to play ball on especially if there is if infrastructure is passed through another budget reconciliation package, which allows more people to kind of get their own priorities and their pet projects in. I mean, it was interesting. I mean, some sources that I talked to kind of pointed out that as far as the first budget reconciliation package with the COVID-19 plan, there was a lot of urgency around that package because, you know, really just wanting to pass the money to get more vaccinations and money and unemployment insurance to people. And I think that there is going to be this process on the infrastructure package is going to be more drawn out. And so people that lawmakers that weren't able to sort of get their pet projects in the first budget reconciliation bill, I think there is going to be a lot more jockeying to get everybody's priorities addressed in this next one. And earmarks could potentially, I think Democrats are certainly hoping that earmarks incentivize Republicans to play ball on this one, but we'll have to wait and see.
Ella Nielsen, White House reporter for Vox.com. Read her work at that website. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 98, closing at a new record, 33,171. But NASDAQ was down 79, putting it into correction territory, off 10% from its 52-week high. S&P down 3. That huge container ship, the Ever Given, has now been freed from blocking the Suez Canal. A lot of tugboats, a little help from the high tides did it, but it's going to take some time for the over 350 ships, which have been waiting for nearly a week, to get through. U.S. Embassy in Cairo tweeting, congratulations to Egypt on freeing the Ever Given and unblocking the Suez Canal. The U.S. proudly partners with Egypt in many areas, including securing the world's waterways and global commons, a collaborative effort that benefits the whole world. Washington Today continues in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. U.S. Supreme Court agreeing to decide whether Kentucky's Republican Attorney General can defend a controversial abortion-related law that had been struck down by a lower court. the percentage of Americans who are members of a house of worship dropping below 50% for the first time in 8 decades, according to a new poll from Gallup. And Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina says that he will have surgery next week for prostate cancer. He says the cancer was found early. He expects to make a full recovery. Tillis is 60 years old. He was just reelected in November to a second 6-year term. Former President Donald Trump over the weekend suggesting he may visit the U.S.-Mexico border over the next few weeks, criticizing the current president, Joe Biden's immigration policies, particularly the number of unaccompanied migrant children arriving recently, overwhelming facilities run by both the Homeland Security Department and Health and Human Services departments. President Biden responding, telling reporters on Sunday, "We're putting in place a plan that I feel very confident about, and I don't care what the other guy does." White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki asked about it during her briefing today.
Well, what we're working to do is put in place steps and actions to help address the situation at the border, including, of course, expediting processing and opening up additional shelters, but also reinstituting policies like the Central American Minors Program to encourage young people to apply in their country and not make that treacherous journey. We are also in a circumstance where we are digging out of a broken system. Over the past 4 years, not just the inhumane policies, but the fact that there were never efforts put in place to look for and seek shelters where these children could be safely and humanely housed. They had a different policy than the president has, of course. But also there was a hiring freeze at ORR in the Refugee Resettlement Office, which made it something that we had to also dig out of when we started. So that's where our focus is on. We are hopeful that as we put these in place, these measures, we can help to address and stem the challenges at the border.
The White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki. A new poll finding that 62% of Americans disapprove of President Biden's handling of immigration issues. That comes from YouGov and Yahoo News. Republican Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma was part of a delegation last week of Senate Republicans at the Rio Grande Valley along the U.S.-Mexico border. Today, he was interviewed by Brian Kilmeade on Fox Radio.
Well, if you look at the national media, they just ignore what's happening on the border. They'll talk about it for a day or two and then just go on and to be able to drop it. This is a payback to his progressive left that said we need to have open borders so he can say publicly we don't have open borders. And every one of the activists know we really do have open borders. Brian, let me tell you, when I was there on Thursday night, we went down to a bridge check-in location in South Texas. And at that check-in location, the Border Patrol are not turning around people or arresting people that are coming across the border. They're processing them within 2 hours and releasing them into the country with a piece of paper that says, appear in this court hearing 3 years from now. So it is literally a get into the United States for the next 3 years and then appear at this court hearing. And I assume most of those folks are never going to show up. If you bring a child with you that's 5 years old, even if there are 10 members of your family, if one of them is five and under, then the whole family gets into the country for the next 3 years. If you're an unaccompanied minor, you get in. And the way the smugglers actually work this to get the adults in is they'll send a group of 100 children and families one direction and then go 5 miles down the border and to be able to take a group of adults across. So we have an open border at this point. Adults have an easy passage to be able to get in. And anyone with a 5 or 6 year old that wants to be able to come into the country, bring as many people as you want with no way to verify all of those folks are actually family. They're being released in the country.
Senator James Lankford on Fox News. Axios reports that the Biden administration projects the number of unaccompanied children crossing the southern border could go from 16,000 this month to as many as 26,000 in September. That according to documents leaked to Axios. National Journal's Against the Grain column reads, Senator Kyrsten Sinema, a Democratic maverick, has seen her popularity crater after resisting several progressive demands. But she's playing the long game, and her moderation will pay dividends in the future. Joining us now is that columnist, Josh Krasher. Thanks so much for being here. What demands has she resisted, and how has that affected her support in Arizona, at least in the short term?
Well, most significantly, she has explicitly said she will not support getting rid of the legislative filibuster, which would be the process in which a lot of legislation favored by progressives in the Democratic Party could get through. But along with Joe Manchin, she has been a pretty stalwart opponent to letting to lowering or repealing that threshold. So that's something that's really driven a lot of progressives in her home state crazy, and then they've been lobbying her to change her position to no avail. The other big move in the last month is her vote on the $15 minimum wage provision as part of the stimulus. Not only did she oppose raising the minimum wage to that level, but she also did it in a very ostentatious way on the Senate floor, giving a thumbs down, making sure that everyone saw and knew her position on that issue. Now, she doesn't favor increasing the minimum wage, just not at that $15 level that Democrats, a lot of Democrats want. So she's really, in a very high-profile fashion, put her stamp on the mood of the Democratic Party. And she's lost support back home, according to one pretty respected poll. Only 50% of Democrats in her home state now view her favorably, which is pretty low considering most partisans support their senators. It's usually around 70, 80, 90% in general. She's only at 50%, contributing to some declining support back home.
You also write, though, that despite the short-term setback, she's making the right moves for her long-term political future. What do you mean by that?
She's not up for re-election until 2024. And Arizona, even though it's voted for two Democratic senators in the last two elections, it's a pretty Republican state. It generally has voted Republican. At the very least, it's a purple state where Republicans and Democrats alike need to be pretty moderate to win statewide elections. And her thinking is, look, she needs to show, as a first-term senator, she needs to show that she's going to live up to her promises to be a bipartisan voice, to be a moderate, to represent the moderate voters of Arizona that supported her in the last campaign. So she's playing the long game. Maybe she takes a hit from the base in the short term, but in 2024, when there's a presidential election, when there's a lot more at stake, you know, I think she's built a lot of important political capital from all voters. In fact, in that same poll, about a third of Republicans actually view her favorably, which is a remarkably high number given how polarized we are as a country. So she's hoping to buy goodwill from independents and even some moderate Republicans, and betting, and I think smartly, that the Democratic anger is going to wear off in a few years.
You also go into how Senator Sinema's situation might be helping the other Democratic senator from Arizona, Mark Kelly.
That's right. Mark Kelly is actually up again for re-election in 2022, next year. And because she's become such a lightning rod on all issues, especially within her own party, there's not been a lot of attention paid to Mark Kelly, who's the guy who's actually on a ballot next year in Arizona and has a little bit more at stake. And, you know, he has been more part. He certainly hasn't broken with the party in such a significant way as Sinema has these first 3 months of the year. But he also has, generally been a party line guy, and he's not facing the backlash that Sinema has. But in a way, Sinema may be helping her in-state colleague because she's taking the brunt of the criticism, at least within the Democratic Party. He's able to do his thing. You know, he's certainly focused on the immigration and border security issues right now. But there's not been as much scrutiny paid to Kelly, and that's a good thing when you're up for re-election in just a year's time.
We're talking with Josh Kroshauer from National Journal. When Senator Sinema ran for election and she presented herself as a certain type of Democrat, is that the way she's voting now? Or, as you said, is she making some political calculation and changing her views?
Well, the fascinating thing about Senator Sinema, and I covered her race in Arizona a lot in 2018, the rap on her was that she used to be a very progressive activist. She was hung out with protests with the activist group Code Pink. She associated with the Green Party early in her political career. She was a state legislator and took the most progressive issues on a whole bunch of legislation. So this is sort of unusual. This is really, you're right, that she has undergone a political evolution. To win elections in Arizona, you've got to be pretty moderate. But if you read her book and you listen to her statement, she actually says, she learned that the only way to get things done is to work with people on the other side and to understand areas of mutual interest. So, I mean, whether you think it's principled or cynical, she clearly believes that being pragmatic and moderate is the way to go, both to get legislation done and to help, frankly, her own political standing back home. So, I don't see her changing her mind on the filibuster anytime soon. And I see her being a pretty reliably partisan vote on a whole lot of things,
But I think she's very attuned to where her voters are. I think she's very attuned to the risks that the Democratic Party would face if they went full bore, removed the filibuster, and then brought to the floor a whole lot of legislation that could be quite unpopular with swing voters.
Josh Krushauer is senior national political columnist with National Journal. Read his Against the Grain column at NJ.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
And the Senate, as well as the House, out for a couple of weeks for the Easter and Passover holidays, returning the week of April 12th. You can follow the Senate live on C-SPAN 2, the House live on C-SPAN, or listen to them both on the free C-SPAN radio app. And thanks for being with us today on Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to download that free app to listen wherever you are. Hope you have a good evening.